It's time for Capital Thinking, where we analyze the key policy, political, legal, and business issues that will shape America's future. Live from Washington, D.C., this is your unfiltered tour of the halls of power. Now, here's your host, Kevin O'Neill.
All right. Good afternoon, America. Welcome to our show. We got a very good hour of issues for you, and we started off today with one of my favorite people, the guy I like to call Mr. Budget here in Washington, Stan Collender, partner at Corvus Communications, a guy with huge experience, 3 decades here in D.C. working on communications issues, but also with a real focus on what happens in the United States budget. And, of course, Stan, this week is budget week. The president had delayed his budget introduction by a week. It came out Monday. I had lots of friends toiling away through Valentine's Day, sort of reading, absorbing, and putting out material. So give me your quick impressions of what the president's document for fiscal year 13 looks like. What do you think?
First thing everyone needs to keep in mind is that this budget is less of a budget, less a serious policy document than it is a campaign statement. Much like the State of the Union, this is the president saying, hey, I know the Republicans aren't going to pass anything I put up there, so I'm just going to put up what I would do if I were in charge all by myself. So what you've got is
one of my colleagues, Stan, called it a Valentine to his reelection campaign.
Oh, I don't think there's any doubt. Your colleague is very eloquent, and I think right on the mark. But you know, the president, I mean, I think we talked about this before. This is a year when nothing really is going to happen on the budget or on the deficit. It's an election year. We're in the middle of hyperpartisan politics. There aren't majorities to do much of anything. Certainly nothing on the debt, deficit, taxes, or spending. So the president put out a budget that he knew wasn't going to be accepted, and therefore he had the freedom to propose whatever he wanted. So it proposes, for example, about a $200 billion increase in the deficit in the short term. That's an increase. But it includes money for state and local governments to hire back or to not fire first responders, to hire back or not fire teachers, for infrastructure, you know, for additional transportation projects. It's very much a Democratic budget, and it will allow the president, as he's been doing, to go out and talk about the individual pieces of the budget without talking about, the budget as a whole. So, that's the way to think about this. The individual pieces are far less important.
Well, I want to get to the political response first in a minute, but I want to ask you, there's been news sort of breaking in the last day or so that we're going to finally see a deal cut between House Republicans and Senate Democrats and the president on extending the payroll tax holiday for the remainder of 2012, as well as looping in the so-called doc fix and extending unemployment benefits. And I know there's a real linkage here between that deal cut and what it means politically for Republicans and the budget. So tell me about the deal and what that linkage is.
Well, there are a lot of interesting things going on here. Just to make sure everyone's reading off the same sheet of music, the existing reduction in the payroll tax is set to expire February 29th at midnight. This deal will keep the payroll tax cut in place through the end of calendar 2012 for the average person. That means about $20 a week in additional spending, which doesn't seem like much on a micro level, but on a macro level, it will help a little bit with the economy, and that was the thinking behind it. It's also an election year tax cut, don't forget. But the deal also includes an extension of unemployment benefits, the doc fix, or fixing the doc fix, so that there's not a big reduction in Medicare payments to doctors, but the payroll tax cut is the one that we need to focus on here, because Republicans decided not to push, in spite of what the Tea Party folks wanted them to do, Republicans in the House decided not to push to get the payroll tax cut paid for, that is to have offsetting spending cuts. As a result, it will go into place and will cost $85 billion or thereabouts in additional deficits this year alone.
Interesting. They're sort of stepping all over themselves here. Well, I love when the budget comes out, because the opposition party in Congress sort of rushes to have a press conference, and the phrase "dead on arrival" is, you know, usually quick to come out of their mouths on budget day. Is this dead on arrival? I mean, we are, you know, one of the other great talking points that Republicans have going for them right now, Stan, is that it's been more than 1,000 days. I don't know the exact count. You might since the Senate passed a budget. It seems to me like we might be about to go all of 2012 too. Sort of walk us through the next steps, if you will, on the budget process in the House and the Senate, and whether or not the president's budget is just an expensive doorstop.
Yeah, a lot of different things there, Kevin. First of all, the president's budget was not dead on arrival. It was dead before typesetting. Or whatever the digital equivalent. Don't forget, the budget comes out online now, as opposed to the days when you and I used to wait online to get it at the
government personal copies. Yeah.
So dead before typesetting. And as I said a second ago, that the White House probably liked that because it meant they were free to do whatever they wanted. The House will almost certainly pass some version, some derivative of what Paul Ryan, the chairman of the House Budget Committee, proposed last year, with changes in his Medicare plan so they don't look as onerous, and maybe even a little bit more bipartisan. That's a bill that the Senate has already said it will not take up. In fact, Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid has already said the Senate's not going to take up any budget this year. So the last time Congress approved a budget resolution was 2009. April 29th, 2009, and it looks like we're going to go through all the way 2012 without one. But Kevin, I got to tell you, you and I talk about budgets and budget resolutions and things like that a lot. The country hasn't come to a ground to a halt. The financial system hasn't stopped working without a federal budget. You know, so I'm not sure there are that many people that honestly care about it, except for you, me, and maybe my mother.
Really, the issue has been the debt ceiling, that the real byproduct, if you will, of not responsibly passing a budget is we're letting the debt continue to climb at astronomical pace. So I want you to talk a little bit about the challenges that come from that in the year ahead.
Yeah, well, I mean, first of all, whether or not you have a budget, that is, whether or not Congress passes a budget, the debt's going to go up as long as the budget projects a deficit, and this one would, each of the last few would, and they would. So you can have a debt increase, so the government will borrow more with or without a, quote, budget resolution, which is what Congress passes. Part of the deal that we talked about, I think, last year, this is back in August, Congress passed, the president signed the Budget Control Act. It allowed three increases in the debt ceiling. Right now it looks as if they won't need to raise the debt ceiling again until after the election, maybe not until early January, but certainly not before the election. And that's going to be a battle royal. My guess is, as we've had in the past, they'll fight up to the last minute. But unless they want to threaten default again by the federal government or worse, another downgrade, it will be dealt with, but it will be destabilizing to markets. Markets don't like that kind of, uncertainty. It will get done, but it will be ugly before it happens.
Yeah, well, it's already ugly. Stan, one of the things I hear a lot of when I talk to my friends about what's going on in Washington is just this sense that Congress is continuing to use the budget process, the president is continuing to use the budget process to duck all the tough questions. They don't have to pass a budget. They're really not doing very well with the appropriations process. The Bull-Simpson Commission went nowhere. And talk to us about the long-term implications of continuing along this path where we don't really seriously address the problems that are growing inside entitlements and in discretionary spending.
Well, let me give you one of the great ironies in life, in Washington life. It's a little bit of a secret, and that is, if we do nothing on the budget, if we just let current law go into place, it means that the Bush-Obama tax cuts will expire at the end of 2012.
Right.
That the payroll tax won't be extended at the end. The payroll tax cut won't be extended at the end of 2012.
Doc fix won't be there.
And that the doc fix and the sequester, that is the automatic across-the-board cuts that would start January 2nd. If you let all that go into place, and if the economy continues to grow at even the moderate levels, the deficit would very quickly, I mean, as in a year or two, fall to levels at which the average economist would say not a big deal. Now, it wouldn't eliminate the deficit, but it would cut spending and increase revenues to the point where we on an economic basis, it wouldn't be that big an issue and Wall Street wouldn't care. The problem, of course, is without a plan, without a budget, without the two sides being able to agree on everything, what they're going to do is just muddle through, as you kind of indicated in your question. And it means the big problem with Medicare that's coming 2017 or thereabouts, the bigger problem with Social Security that's coming 2040, 2037, somewhere in there, they won't be addressed. And, we'll be just going from crisis to crisis and wind whipped. And it's not really the best way to run a railroad, let alone a country.
Yeah, it's definitely not the right way to win the issue on budget. Stan, any sort of wrapping thoughts on what you think will happen the next couple of months? You haven't mentioned Paul Ryan and the Republican sort of budget. And I want to give you a chance to do that in the 2 minutes.
Well, here's the big change from last year. Last year we had, and forgive me for using this phrase, a series of hostage taking opportunities. That is, the government was funded under a series of short term funding bills, known as continuing resolutions. Every time one of those came up, the Republicans in the House tried to use it to get the administration, to get the Democrats in the Senate in particular, to do certain things. Those opportunities are gone this year because the government is now funded not with a short-term bill, the long-term bill through the end of September 30. That is the end of the fiscal year. Same thing is true with the debt ceiling. I mentioned that a second ago. That'll go through at least the election, if not beyond. And with the payroll tax situation being resolved, it means there's not even a hostage-taking opportunity there. So what you're going to get this year is a year of a lot of smoke on the budget, like the House considering the Paul Ryan plan, but not a lot of fire. And my guess is that I hope you and I get a chance to talk about this a lot, but I don't think we'll be talking about specific changes or specific opportunities or proposals. Instead, it's going to be a lot of recriminations and finger pointing.
All right, Mr. Budget, Stan Collender. We'll be back some other time to talk about the budget process as it moves forward. We'll be back in just a minute after this commercial break to get into SOPA and PIPA and talk about anti-internet piracy legislation right here on Capital Thinking. More in a moment.
Stocks, bonds, investment opportunities, financial news, and talk. We can help. Call us now toll-free, 866-472-5790. 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
If you find yourself under the Klieg lights of a government investigation, you want experience on your side. Patton Boggs has 46 years of it. We've handled some of the biggest white-collar crime cases. Put that experience to work for you.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
It's all about action.
Touchdown!
Scores.
Taking a look at the NBA tonight.
Highlights.
Oh, he's broken loose. He's at the 30.
And headlines.
Big trade in the NFL this afternoon.
When you are looking to talk sports, look no further than the Voice America Sports Network. We bring you some of the biggest names and all the sports news you can handle, whether it's basketball.
Off the glass.
Football.
Come on.
Golf. Racing. Or the Olympics. We've got you covered. We'll even cover tailgating. Tune in to the Voice America Sports Network. It's all things sports.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Hear ye, hear ye. The House will come to order.
Having trouble sorting out what's going on Capitol Hill? Patton Boggs can cut through it all. We've got the insight, the know-how, the connections to navigate. Patton Boggs. Straight, unfiltered. Patton Boggs, a bipartisan voice with knowledge and 46 years of experience.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
Voice America Business Network, the bottom line in business.
Live from Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's koneill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
Welcome back, everybody. We're going to talk a little bit about anti-internet piracy legislation, and our guest is a first-timer here on Capital Thinking. It's Travis Crabtree. Travis runs an online media blog called emedialaw.com. He's a guy with a very interesting background, spent some time graduating from the University of Missouri School of Journalism, which is almost as good as Syracuse University, both in basketball and in journalism, Travis. And then he worked in television news before taking a wicked left turn and headed to law school and now to a legal career. And Travis, welcome to the show. I want to talk to you a little bit about SOPA and PIPA, which are common words here heard here in Washington, but maybe not as well known to our listeners. So tell us a little bit about what those acronyms mean and how they relate to internet piracy.
Sure. PIPA is the Senate's version. The full name of that one is the Preventing Real Online Threats to Economic Creativity and Theft of Intellectual Property Act. That's a mouthful, so PIPA always is easier. SOPA is a little easier to understand, the acronym anyway. It's Stop Online Piracy Act. And both of these competing provisions were kind of supported by Hollywood and content creators trying to get Congress to act in order to stop the online piracy of movies, music, books, pretty much anything else by foreign websites. There are already mechanisms in place for domestic websites, things like the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, that content creators can take advantage of. But the problem is, if the site is being hosted in a foreign country, there's not a lot on the books right now that specifically target those sites and specifically address what Hollywood or music creators can do with regard to preventing those sites from putting out there free the works that these folks have created.
Very good. Well, this is fascinating legislative fight, Travis, for me in Washington, because it pits two huge industries against each other. You got Hollywood on one side, you got Silicon Valley on the other. I just got done reading earlier today an article about the president's trip out to Hollywood and the somewhat awkward nature of that trip, because basically the president has come down on Silicon Valley's side, it seems, to be on this fight. But walk us into some of the details of what's in these bills and tell us sort of what the two sides are of them.
Sure. It has made for strange bedfellows. I mean, on one side supporting it, you have the U.S. Chamber of Commerce along with the AFL-CIO, and those two normally don't team up, but they're together on this for the protection of the jobs, and their big push is that this is not going to, you know, support George Clooney and make him any richer. He doesn't need to be any richer. When there's a TV show, there's hundreds of guys behind the scenes who, you know, are making $20,000, $40,000, $75,000 a year. And if this content is being pirated and available out there for free, there's no money to pay for these guys to do the microphone work and the backstage work. And so that's why those folks are together. And then on the other side of it, like you mentioned, are all of the major players, all of the major internet players, Google, Yahoo, and then the ACLU has sort of jumped on their bandwagon as well, and folks like that who are against the bill. And really what it comes down to is the internet at least has this persona of being the last frontier of non-regulations. Now, that's not completely true, but compared to most other aspects of our life, it is fairly unregulated, which is one reason it's been able to explode the way it has. You know, in order to open up an online business, I don't have to get a permit from City Hall. I don't have to do all these things. I go to GoDaddy and get my little domain name, and boom, I'm running an online business. And so there's very little to get in the way, and any time the government gets involved in the internet, it creates a major hoopla. And that's what this one has done. Now, the most of the focus has been on the congressional version, SOPA, the Stop Online Piracy Act. You know, again, to demonstrate how this doesn't even follow through partisan lines, you know, that one was put forth by Lamar Smith, a Republican congressman from Texas. The Senate's version was done by Patrick Leahy of Vermont. And the reason most of the focus has been on SOPA is because they've had some hearings on it, whereas PIPA was put forth, and within a matter of weeks, it was on the floor and basically approved by the Senate with very little debate way back in May. SOPA's had a little bit more debate about it, a couple of hearings, and so there's been a lot more attention to SOPA. And the main issue is that it goes after foreign websites who are dedicated to the theft of U.S. property. That's the magical language. So, you know, obviously, as lawyers, we know, okay, well, what in the world does that mean? What does it mean if a site is dedicated to the theft of U.S. property? And that is defined in SOPA under Section 103. And that's where a lot of the fight has been about this definition, and whether or not it is way too broad or whether it gets the job done. Now, Section 103 defines a site that's, quote, dedicated to the theft of U.S. property, unquote, as one that is primarily designed to offer goods that enables or facilitates infringement. You know, is the site primarily designed to put pirated movies up there? And it's not just pirated movies, it's the fake Gucci purse.
What I'm buying, Travis. A lot of fake Gucci these days.
You know, Valentine's Day was 2 days ago, so.
Yeah, exactly.
So it's after that, it's after pharma. Pharma's in support of this because it's not hard to go online and get, you know, hey, we're offshore, you can get the drugs a lot cheaper.
Well, let me jump back in here, Travis. What is very confusing to me, getting sort of barraged with email messages and Facebook posts and seeing advertisements on TV, is I have one side that says this is a huge infringement of the First Amendment rights and it's going to chill what goes on online, maybe even shut down vital parts of the Internet. And then I have the other side saying completely overblown, none of that's going to happen. Talk to me about the First Amendment and implications.
Sure. The First Amendment implications are, you know, websites that allow for comments, your blogs, your Facebooks, any user-generated comments. The concern is, again, gets back to that definition, and one of the key phrases is whether a site facilitates or enables infringement. So if I go to your blog and I comment and I simply link to, under your comments or your blog, to another website, that is sort of a pirated website. You know, I could do, thanks for having me on, here's an example of a website that could be a target of it, and I provide a link to it. Well, what could happen if the law is read very broadly, and nobody agrees with how the law is to be interpreted, which is a problem with it and why it's going back to the drawing board, they are saying that because I've simply linked to this site on your blog, that you have now enabled or facilitated the infringement of these works. And so they could go after your site, and they can go after it by telling Google to take you down, by telling PayPal or other payment processors not to process payments if you have an e-commerce site. They could tell ad networks, if you're running banner ads, to, you know, to stop doing that. They can go so far as to tell your internet service provider to stop allowing users to go to that site. And so that's where the big concern about the First Amendment is, and one of the people that can do this is the U.S. government, the Department of Justice. And so you do have sort of the alarmists out there saying, oh, the government can now concoct some copyright claim and get rid of sites that are criticizing the government.
Yeah. Talk to me, I guess, about a little bit about the protections that are already in place on the Internet.
Sure. There's, you know, with domestic sites, if I put up a video on Google that is copyrighted by somebody else, there's the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. And it's got its detractors and supporters as well. It's definitely not perfect, but it's been around for going on 7 years now. And what that is if it's my content, I send YouTube what you call a DMCA notice, and then YouTube generally takes it down, because if they do that, they can't be sued. It's a safe harbor for them. The only result of me being the person that put it up there is I can do a counter notice, and then we can sue each other, but YouTube's out of it. So that's already in place, and is one way that protects this this copyrighted works and content creators. Now, obviously, that puts the burden on the content creator and not on the sites like YouTube, and that's sort of what the debate is about, the validity or the strengths and weaknesses of that law. There's other things. There's ICE, for example, has shut down some websites by just taking the domain names, because those domain names are registered through, for example, GoDaddy, which is based here in the United States. They can take those domain names as an in-rem action when it's clear that that site is selling those fake Gucci purses that you've been buying. And so they've done it that way. So there are some things in place. And one of the new proposals is something called OPEN, which is, you know, a Senate version and a congressional version. Daryl Issa's got the congressional version. He's a Republican out of California. Senator Juan Wyden out of Oregon has proposed it in the Senate, and it really shifts this to the ITC, the International Trade Commission, and says, you guys be the arbiters, you guys be the judges, you guys enforce this to keep these foreign sites from taking U.S. intellectual property.
Gotcha. Gotcha. Well, tell me real fast in the time we've got left, about 90 seconds, what's the current status and outlook for these bills?
Well, they had the both of them have kind of been tabled for right now. And so the expectation is they are going back to the drawing board. After the congressional hearing in December on SOPA, both of these bills sort of got tabled and pulled. There's a lot more attention on it now. That's when OPEN got proposed. And with the zealousness of the Internet, there's going to be a lot of attention paid, and I'm not sure there's much going to be done during this election year because it is such a hot-button issue with weird competing interests.
Yeah, very good. Well, we've been joined by Travis Crabtree. I encourage you to get out to his blog, which is emedialaw.com, and read more about his thoughts on what's going on in the intersection between media and the legal world. We're going to be back in just a minute with more Capital Thinking, talking about the GOP presidential race right after the break here.
The market's up or down, or if you're looking to improve your portfolio, our experts are ready to talk to you. Call now toll free 866-472-5790. That's 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
What's your name worth? The loss of a single patent, trademark, or copyright can cost millions. Make sure your intellectual property is protected. Trust Patton Boggs to manage and protect your most important assets.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
Are you looking for innovative ideas on how to achieve your financial dreams? Tune in to Empirical Investing Radio every Thursday afternoon at 2 Pacific, 5 Eastern on the Voice America Business Channel. Join certified financial planners Ken Smith and Ethan Broga to learn how you can obtain financial success. You'll be entertained while you discover techniques to alleviate your financial concerns. Empirical Investing Radio every Thursday at 2 Pacific, 5 Eastern on the Voice America Business Channel.
Technology is changing the way we live our lives and how we do business. On CIO Talk Radio, we talk about the benefits of technology and the great things it allows us to do, as well as its risks. Heard every Wednesday at 9 a.m. Central, 7 a.m. Pacific, Sunjoe Gall interviews business leaders and other experts that are shaping the way we use technology. To learn more about the show, visit www.ciotalkradio.com. Keep up with the changing world of technology and listen to CIO Talk Radio with Sunjoe Gall. Listen in every Wednesday at 9 a.m. Central, 7 a.m. Pacific, right here on Voice America Business.
The business community's first choice in Internet Talk Radio, Voice America Business Network.
From Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's koneill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right, welcome back. Well, we're going to talk about the presidential race. I'm joined by one of my colleagues who's literally just down the hall from me, one of my good friends, Bob Horn, here at Patton Boggs. Bob is a guy who has a very interesting background. He is, before coming to the firm, he was a special assistant to Governor George Romney. That name sounds so familiar. When Governor Romney was the Secretary of Housing and Urban Development, Bob also worked in the Ford White House and headed up the state of Michigan's D.C. office under Governor Milliken. And then was a vice president for Detroit Edison in charge of federal affairs. And also, notably, Bob is the founder and a key leader still in the Republican National Lawyers Association. So we wanted to bring Bob on, talk a little bit about what's going on in the presidential race, especially as thoughts turn to Michigan. But, Bob, the story really this week has been Rick Santorum. So he had a very surprising set of election results last week in Minnesota, Missouri, and Colorado, where he swept those races, and now national polls show him in a statistical tie with Governor Romney for the Republican nomination. How surprised are you by those finishes and Santorum's sudden momentum?
Well, thank you for having me on, Kevin. I was thinking back on some of this in preparation for this discussion, and I thought that as recently as a month ago, I couldn't have predicted that Rick Santorum would be the leading national polls for the Republican presidential nomination. That's not to say I didn't think of it at all, but I just didn't think it was probable because he didn't have the organization, didn't have the structure, didn't have the money, a lot of didn't haves. But what he does have and what seems to be the discriminator in his case is the fact that he has connectivity with a large segment of the Republican primary electorate. And you've got to remember that people who vote in primaries are more to the left if they're Democrats or right to the if they're Republicans.
Right. It's the true believers.
It's the true believers because they have the incentive to come out and vote.
Well, you know, and we've seen Romney be all over the map on where how true believers view him in some of these early states. He's done very well in some with that category. He's not done as well in others, and that's typically then been reflected in the overall performance in that state. Now, Michigan, when you think of Michigan, Bob, everyone thinks of the downtrodden auto industry and what's being done there to help it recover. The president is making the GM bailout one of the centerpieces of his reelection, claiming it is a great victory of government intervention. You obviously are very well connected, having spent 40 years working in and around federal relations and the state of Michigan. So tell me, Santorum versus Romney there, how does the jobs and economy message translate for both of those guys? Who does it give sort of a better opportunity to succeed in this primary coming up?
First of all, I want to tell you to explain that Michigan is changing, and it's changing demographically. All of Michigan is not major, does not have major financial troubles. As you go to the western part of the state, in and around Grand Rapids, things are doing incredibly well there. And so the more you delve into what's happening in the western part of the state, you're looking at a success story, and largely as a result of a new industry, technology, Amway, a whole bunch of things, not auto-related, and the ties to Chicago, which are very strong economically. As you go to the eastern part of the state, the auto industry becomes very, very important. And Detroit, in large part, is still substantially upside down. Jobs there become a very important issue. But again, you're dealing with a Republican electorate. And the vast majority of that electorate, for purposes of the primary, are in the western part of the state. So issues other than jobs become very important. It is also the home of the Tea Party movement in Michigan. And it is the area which is far more conservative and far more politically active on the Republican side than Detroit, or even the Wayne County or Macomb County or all the counties around Detroit. So jobs play a big part of the issues in the state generally because of its economic viability, but not as much as some of the pundits say.
Gotcha. Well, let's switch to the Democratic side of the aisle here, Bob. President Obama, he's starting to peak above 50% in some national polls. His approval ratings seem to be up, and part of that seems to be the trailing edge of what looks like a fairly sustained wave now of a few months of good economic news. Stock market moving up, unemployment rate moving down. Now that could be tempered if gas prices start to jump through the roof, but talk to me about what that polling data means on the Republican primary side as we go forward.
Romney's principal argument up to now is his experience as a businessman. He has essentially said that he can do better in managing the economy than President Obama has done. If that issue tempers, and if things go better economically, the substance of the Romney argument begins to diminish. It's really very interesting. Obama is running around the country right now saying to most of us that things have turned around, things are better, and therefore he deserves re-election. Ironically, that is the same strategy that Ronald Reagan ran on in his second term election. Unemployment was still high, the economy was just beginning to come out of the recession, but he was talking about all the good things that are America and all the good things that America can become again. When he talked about his view of the world and his view of where America stood economically. And I think that's going to be the Obama game, providing the numbers hold up. There's an enormous distance in time between now and the election, and things are subject to all kinds of changes. For example, if the Iranians close down the Bay of Hormuz, or if the Eurozone begins to fail, all that would impact enormously on our economics.
Yeah, and I hear a lot of people saying, and I think with some note of truth, Bob, that puts Republicans in a bad position because they essentially have to root for bad news.
Well, that's the danger. And there's no question about that. But I also think that the Republican candidate, whoever it's going to be, has the opportunity to show that regardless of what the outcomes are in the short term, the long-term problems are so difficult, and the president has done such a bad job in trying to address it, for example, with regard to the deficit, which was a big issue 2 years ago, that in fact a Republican change could be beneficial. But that requires a very sophisticated, articulate presentation, which so far has not been made.
Yeah, now I also hear people saying two things, Bob. This is our last question. I've got about 2 minutes left for you. Either it's enough to run as the anti-Obama, or you need to have a real bold agenda that differentiates you between them. And there's some sense that none of the Republican nominees are doing anything more than running as the anti-Obama. So what do you think they need to do in the next few months? Do you agree with that assertion or not?
In part. The problem is you've got two different races that you're facing. You're facing one, the primary, and then the general election. The difficult thing for any party that's out of power is to define itself. Republicans in this primary process really have to figure out what conservatism means, whether it's social or economic. Right now, the primary candidates are focusing on a whole bunch of peripheral issues. When it comes to the general election, I think that'll change. And I think there's time to make the adjustment.
Very good. Well, Bob, I think we're going to sort of wrap things up there. Actually, I think I got time for one more question. We haven't mentioned Newt Gingrich at all. He's an afterthought in the polling in Michigan and a couple of these other states. If you're Santorum, are you pushing him to get out?
Absolutely. If there's one anti-Romney candidate, he's going to have much better chance of prevailing than if the multitude exists. In closing, though, there's a phenomenon that I don't think many people have talked about. Romney is trying very hard to ingratiate himself to some of the people who you wouldn't imagine he'd appeal to. And I think over time what you're going to get is an effort to bring in not necessarily the Santorum or the Gingrich folks in the front end, but some of the people who are enthusiastic libertarians.
Interesting. Enthusiastic libertarians. They sound like a lot of fun fun to party with, Bob.
Well,
we're going to keep our eye on. I think Michigan's going to be a fascinating race. It's an interesting time leading up to Super Tuesday in a couple weeks, and this presidential primary season hasn't worked out the way a lot of people thought it would, and it's been a much more enjoyable thing to view from a distance than if it had gone the way folks probably thought. We're going to be back in just a minute with more Capital Thinking. Until then, keep it here for this commercial break.
Thank you.
Whether the market's up or down, or if you're looking to improve your portfolio, our experts are ready to talk to you. Call now, toll free, 866-472-5790. That's 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
From K Street to Wall Street to LaSalle Street, the Patton Boggs team knows how to pull off big business transactions. Come hear what we know. Patton Boggs covers the world.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Interrogatories.
Prima facie.
Pleadings.
Motion for summary judgment.
E-discovery.
Affirmative defense.
Stipulations.
Ex parte.
Amicus brief.
Subpoena.
Litigation is confusing. Trust the litigation team at Patton Boggs to make sense of it all.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
The same firm that's been navigating the government maze for more than four decades is also the same firm that can help you protect your most important assets. Whether it's a valuable patent, an important copyright, or your next big idea, Patton Boggs is committed to protecting your intellectual property.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
From Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's koneill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right, well, welcome back. We are going to spend this segment talking about one of the intersections between the business community and the legal world. Joining me are Phil Fagan and Larry Makel, both partners at Patton Boggs here. Phil is somebody who works with private and public companies, working in a variety of spaces, one of which is the small business investment company space. And Larry has been with the firm for a great while, has been the founding partner of our Dallas office and one of the leaders of our business law practice group. He concentrates his practice on structured finance, investment corporations, private investment funds. And guys, we're going to talk a little bit today about the Small Business Administration and their new early stage SBIC program, which has basically created some new opportunities to focus on investment in early stage small business. And Larry, I want to turn it over to you to sort of kick things off and have a little dialogue going with Phil here.
Thank you very much. Bill, we just had a second before we got on here, and I'm being deluged with questions and inquiries from people who are starved for capital. More importantly, a lot of folks have had funds. Some people are trying to do their first fund. We have some remnants of the old participating preferred program that are trying to figure out how they can get back into the SBIC program, and obviously don't have any debenture or sub-debt experience. So everybody wants to know about the early stage SBIC program. So what I would ask you to do is, for anyone listening, that this would be a great opportunity to sort of describe to them generally what it's about.
Sure. It's a new program and has not been finalized or come into existence, but the SBA has said that they're going to finalize the rules within the next month or two, and they're going to open up for applications for the early stage program. What it is a focus on investing in businesses that really don't have positive cash flow or have limited cash flow at the time. It's designed for traditional venture funds that invest in equity, not lending. And as you know, Larry, for quite some time now, the SBA has had a more traditional debenture type program, which really focused on middle market mezzanine type financing where money was being lent or we had debt with warrants. This is really for people who come in the early stage and are taking more of a gamble on companies. And it's part of a job, it came about through a job package that President Obama pushed, and is really to focus on getting more jobs through startup companies. The major focus that I would say, and we can go into it in more detail, is for funds that are able to raise a minimum of $20 million, and the government will match that money up to $50 million as you invest the money. Additionally, it's designed for you to pay back the money to the government over a period of time. And the payments are deferred for the first 5 years, but then you have to pay back the money that you've been lent by the government over a 10-year period.
Is it similar to the old, or what some people would know as the participating preferred program?
Well, it's similar in some respects, and it's different. It's similar in it's designed to attract the same type of companies who are seeking to get investments in the same type of funds that are going to put the money into these smaller companies. But it's different in the model that the SBA is using to lend the money to these SBIC funds. In the old participating securities program, the SBA basically took an interest in each of the companies and was a partner in a sense in each of the investments that were being made. And there was some flaw in the design from the SBA's point of view in that they were paid back as essentially a secondary LP, not at the same time that all the LPs who are invested in the funds are paid back. Here, it's designed more like the current debenture program in that the SBA is paid back at the same time that the fund makes payments to the LPs. So it's a 50-50 split. If the fund is going to pay back money to its LPs, 50% of that money has to go back to the SBA to pay back the money that's been drawn down, and 50% has to go to the LPs. But in order to attract funds to this program, what the SBA has done is push back the payment period to not occur during the first 5 years. And the reason they did that was because obviously when you're making early stage investments, they don't harvest for a period of time. So they're leaving a harvest period so that hopefully the fund will be able to have to be paid, be paying back on its own investments after the first 5 years, and then can pay back the LPs and the SBA.
So let me ask you two kind of technical questions. One would be the issues that people that are familiar with the SBA programs, SBIC programs, always ask. Is it a minimum of 20? Can you go higher? That's part one. The second part will be, when you say that they match it, and when you said if you put in 20, you get 50, is it sort of 1.5 times? In the old conventional term is leverage. So can you maybe explain that to folks?
Sure. No, it's 1-to-1 leverage. In order to qualify to be licensed, you have to have a minimum of $20 million that you raised. Once you've raised the money, you can only draw down from the SBA as much money as is the private capital you raised. So if you've only raised $20 million, you can only borrow $20 million from the government. There's also a ceiling. So the most you could borrow is $50 million. A fund could raise more than $50 million. They could be a $75 million fund, but they can only borrow $50 million. So obviously that would equate to less than 1-to-1 leverage.
Right.
So there's a minimum and a cap.
That's helpful to know. So what do you think the advantages are to doing this, of an SBIC and in particular for this program?
Well, the advantages obviously is leverage. Leverage is always quite attractive to investors because you're putting someone else's money to work to essentially increase the IRR that you will get on each of your returns. So it's easier for these funds to attract investors. In particular, there's been a lot of interest in banks and investing for several reasons. One, banks get CRA credit when they invest in an SBIC, and it's not questionable whether they get it. It's an automatic CRA credit. And for those that don't know, CRA credit is Community Reinvestment Act credit, and banks are required to make sure that a certain amount of their capital is spent in community-related projects.
Bill and Larry, I'm going to have to jump in there because we're actually out of time for the show. I would encourage folks who want more information on this program to come to the Patton Boggs website and look for Larry Makel and Phil Fagan and drop them an email or give a phone call to them and talk a little bit about this new development. We'll be back next Thursday with more Capital Thinking. Until then, keep it here on the Voice America Business Network.
Thank you, Evan.
Thank you for joining us for Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. We hope to have you join us again for more insight from Washington. We're here every Thursday at 9 a.m. Pacific Time, noon Eastern, on the Voice America Business Network.